CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Hotel Mars, Episode N. My colleague and co-host and friend David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show, is here, and we're headed to the moon, also in a time machine to the moon. We welcome someone to help us tell the story of Apollo 16 in 1972, Rob Godwin. He is the publisher of RCG Publishing, a number of books about famous and unknown missions in Apollo land. This is the 20th century. Everything was bigger and fresher and newer because I was, because David was. This is our youth. But now, looking back, there's a sentimental value to examining what happened with Apollo 16. This was the penultimate mission to the moon by the Apollo program. The three astronauts on board Apollo, John Young, he commanded the mission. Command module was Thomas K. Mattingly II. And the lunar module pilot was Charles M. Duke Jr., Charlie Duke. Rob, a very good evening to you. You have spoken with, I believe, Commander Young.
Hi, John.
The memories of this mission are dim now here in the 21st century. What was the mission profile? What was their challenge going to the moon? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Yeah. Well, I mean, the story is it was the fifth successful moon landing, and we'd had Apollo 13 go awry in between. But they got to the point now where science was the main goal of going to the moon. And so Apollo 16 had about two dozen science experiments to conduct. One of the other things that they had to do, one of the three main jobs they had to do, of course, was to collect rocks. And the other thing was to conduct in-flight experiments and take lots of photographs. So, you know, they went out there and did a lot of these experiments on the way there, which included things like using an X-ray detector to look at things like black holes, believe it or not. They were looking at the anomaly in Cygnus, the Cygnus X-1 black hole at the time, and trying to take pictures of that and figure out what that was. And one of the other things which they did was they deployed a satellite in lunar orbit, which was placed there to see if the moon had much of an atmosphere, to look at the moon's magnetic field, if it had one, and to also look at gravitational anomalies on the moon, which they ended up calling mass concentrations.
Wonderful. All wonderful, Rob. Let's take off. April 16th, 1972, the Saturn V. What was that? Why is it famous? How did we lose it, Rob?
Well, we lost it because of Apollo 13, mostly. Apollo 13 was such a sort of catastrophe in the sense of the political hit that after the hearings from Apollo 13, they decided to cut back on the Apollo moon landing program and cancel Apollos 18 and 19, which were going to go to some pretty interesting places. They retasked one of the Saturn V's, which had already been built, to use for America's first space station, which was Skylab. And the other two Saturn V's, which had already been built, ended up as lawn ornaments in Houston and Florida. That's pretty much what happened.
The Saturn V, please explain to our younger audience. It was very big. Is it as big as what is going on in Boca Chica now?
I believe that what they're doing in Boca Chica with SpaceX's Starship is slightly bigger. I'm not sure how many feet it is bigger, but the Saturn V was 365 feet high, three stages with the spacecraft included on top, and it also had a launch escape system tower, which gave it that final height. The big difference, of course, is that Saturn V was powered by kerosene and then cryogenic engines, which use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, so they're very powerful. Whereas I think what SpaceX are up to, they're building their own engines, which, if I'm not mistaken, are using mostly kerosene. I might be wrong about that, but they're using a different kind of propellant. And of course, the thing is that the Starship is going to be able to lift, you know, a huge amount of mass into orbit. The only difference being, I suppose, the main difference being, is it for it to be used as a lander itself. The actual Starship will be landing on the moon. This enormous great thing is planned to land on the moon, whereas with Apollo it was, you know, a 30 foot tall, 33,000 pound tiny little spider-like lander that could only hold two people.
David, I have a question for Ra.
Rob, wasn't Apollo 16 where they also planted some explosives for future seismic testing, and they had to plant explosives on the surface of the moon?
They were going to do that. In fact, they were going to do that on 14. And I had the good fortune of interviewing Edgar Mitchell about the Apollo 14 landing, and he said that they laid out these mortars, and they decided not to fire them in the end because they were set to go off at a certain distance, and they were afraid that it might pollute the other science experiments. And Ed Mitchell told me, he said that they were very, very happy that they didn't have to fire those because they were quite sort of concerned about the danger that those posed. I don't know if 16 actually did fire the mortars. The plan was to fire them after they left. But Ed Mitchell told me that the code for firing them remained active for many, many years. And in theory, somebody with the right frequency and the right code could have ignited them from the ground a decade or more later.
We take off on April 16th, and the voyage out, they go into orbital insertion on April 19th. Any significant events on the way out? And you spoke with John Young. What does he remember about the voyage?
Well, the first question you asked is about the glitches. They had all kinds of gas leaks. They had nitrogen leaks and helium leaks and all kinds of things which caused problems. And they also had a problem with the gimbal mechanism, which is the pointing mechanism on the main spacecraft engine, the service propulsion system on the service module. All of those things contributed to problems later. To the second question you asked, John Young, the main thing that he was concerned about, there was two things, both happened on the moon. One was the leaking orange juice that they had inside the spacesuits. It was a real problem. It turns out that this little nozzle that they had inside the helmet, which was designed to keep them hydrated when they're out on the lunar surface, when they bent over inside the spacecraft to do up their zips on their suits and so forth, this thing would press against the headset microphone and start leaking into the helmet. And by the time they got outside, Charlie Duke's helmet was just coated with orange juice, and he had to live with that on the surface for the entire time they were out there. And indeed, it was so bad that when they got back inside, they had to use a vacuum to try and vacuum the orange juice out of the seals because they were afraid the seals on their helmets wouldn't seal up again. The second thing, which John Young was particularly upset about, even when I interviewed him years and years later, I didn't ask him about it because I knew how upset he'd been about it. But that was, he had tripped over one of the control wires to one of the experiments that they just started to deploy on the lunar surface. And he didn't realize he'd caught his boot in the wire, and he'd actually yanked the thing right out and broken it. And so I didn't ask him about it. And when we were talking at the end of my interview with him, he said, "You didn't ask me about the heat flow." And I said, "Well, you know, I've read everything there's to know about. I know you're upset about it." And he said, "Yeah, I was really, really upset about it." And then he went on about it for 5 minutes, like 20 years later, still mad at himself. And indeed, it wasn't really his fault. The way that the connector was designed, it was so weak that when he trapped his foot in the cable and pulled, he didn't even know he'd pulled it out. There was nothing to stop it from being broken.
David?
Did the crew know that there was just going to be one more mission left for humans to go to the moon, and what were their thoughts about it?
Yes, they did know, because 18 and 19, as I said earlier, had been canceled right after the Apollo 13 hearings in 1970. So by the time Apollo 16 went in April of 72, they'd had almost 2 years to get used to the fact that they were second to last before, you know, Apollo 17 went in December of 72. All of them were concerned about the fact that, you know, that the budget had been cut back and that they were scrapping these perfectly functional Saturn V launch vehicles. Having said that, there were dangers involved, and that was that the solar maximum was starting to gear up, and that's when the sun's output of radiation that's particularly nasty goes in 11-year cycles, and solar maximum was starting to come. And if they'd been on the lunar surface when there'd been a major solar flare or a mass coronal ejection, as they call them, they could have died. And indeed, they missed one by a matter of a few weeks. One of the Apollo crews got home and back inside the Earth's magnetic field, which protected them just before it hit.
We're speaking with Rob Godwin. He is the publisher of RCG Publishing, also our guide on the history of the Apollos. We're at Apollo 16, 50 years, springtime of 1972. David Livingston is Dr. Space. The space show is available all the time across the country. Rob Godwin is the publisher of RCG Publishing. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. I'm John Batchelor. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N, CBSI and the World. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague and co-host and friend David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. And we're having a wonderful memory lane stroll with Rob Godwin, the publisher of RCG Publishing, which has a number of wonderful stories about Apollo and early days of dreaming of landing on the moon and what comes next. Well, we're on the moon right now with Apollo 16. The landing site was chosen in what is called the Descartes site. Most significant to me in my memory is the Lunar Roving Vehicle, the LRV, or the dune buggy. What was it, Rob? How was it put together? What was the ambition of running around on the moon in that strange landscape?
It was built by Boeing, John, and it was designed to get them further afield than they would be able to go on foot. And it had, I think it had like a top speed on the moon of perhaps as much as 16 or 17 kilometers an hour. It was designed to go faster than that, but it was extremely light. They couldn't use pneumatic tires on the moon, so it had these piano wire wheels, which allowed it to have some suspension as they were going around. It was electrically powered, electric motors on two separate systems. It also had steering at the front and the back, but it was light enough that the two astronauts on the moon could actually pick it up bodily and move it around, which turned out to be a useful thing on Apollo 16, because when they first offloaded it from the lander, it turned out the rear steering wasn't working, and they didn't know why, and they were quite concerned about that. So they loaded it up anyway because they knew they were going to go out. Once they got it loaded up, suddenly the rear steering started working, and they thought, okay, fine. So off they went, and on one of their trips out in it, they were trying to go up a particularly steep hill, about a 20-degree angle, and the rear wheels stopped working again. And so it got dug in, and they were discussing it afterwards, what were they going to do if it got stuck? And they said, well, if both the front and back steering had failed, they would literally have driven it towards the lunar lander, and every time it went off course, they'd get out, pick it up, point it in the right direction again, and then get back in and keep going like that. And that was their plan for getting back. But fortunately, they didn't have to do that. The front steering saved the day, and they got back.
A detail. I call it a dune buggy because this is what it looks like. There's no chassis. There's just a couple of guys sitting with looks to be a what is that? Just like paper mache platform.
Well, it did have a chassis, but it was extremely light. I think the thing that was the most remarkable about it, John, was that it also carried a fully functional television studio, which could transmit a TV picture in color live 250,000 miles back to the Earth. And so everywhere they went with it, when they got to where they were going, they stopped, parked, and pointed that antenna, that dish that was on the front of it, at the Earth and switched on the camera, and bingo, you had live pictures from a car on the moon.
Wonderful. David?
Are you following how they're planning to evolve the 2024 or later version of the moon buggy from the original moon buggy? And what's happening there?
I have been following it a little bit, John. I can't say that I'm completely up to speed on it, but I mean, they've been talking about it for so many years now. I mean, what we're talking about is 50 years ago. And so replacement vehicles for the lunar surface have gone through such an evolution in the last 50 years. And indeed, before they went to the moon with Apollo, they had dozens and dozens of different concepts for what they called mobile laboratories. And some of these new designs that they're coming up with now are much more akin to that. And in fact, what it is a fully pressurized vehicle that they can drive from A to B without getting into their spacesuits. And in some cases, some of the designs have spacesuits that are actually built into the door. So once they get where they're going, they sort of like almost like a submarine hatch where they grab the handles and put their feet through first and into the suit, and the suit's actually attached to the door itself. So these new rovers are probably going to be pressurized, which is, you know, like comparing a little tiny sort of Ford Model T to you know, today's mobile home.
The tense moments for the original Apollo 11 was the landing, the final moments before settling down, and then always the question of the takeoff, of returning to the lunar, to the Apollo main spacecraft. Was there any tension in Apollo 16, any of those events?
There was actually, John, because what happened was after they had separated the lunar lander from the command service module, they had a problem with the engine on the command service module again, and they weren't sure whether they should proceed, and so the two spacecraft stayed in orbit a lot longer than they were supposed to do until they figured that, you know, they could sort of hack a fix to what needed to be done. And so when they finally fired the lunar descent engine and went for a landing, they were a lot later than they had expected to be, and so they'd used a lot more electrical power than they were expecting to use. And so when they landed, instead of just going straight outside and starting to do their moonwalk, they had to go to a sleep cycle because they were, you know, hours late. And so that threw off everything. It threw off the clocks that they had on board. They didn't know what time it was, which is incredibly critical if you're going to take off and get home on time with all the plans that were in place. And it also, of course, it threw off the television broadcasts back on the ground, which contributed in part, I think, to the audience not tuning in, because everybody thought they were going to land and go out at a certain time, and they didn't do it until, you know, eight, or it was actually 15 hours later that they went out for their first moonwalk.
David?
What was the range of the Apollo 16 moon buggy?
They were outside for about 20 hours total, David, and that was over three EVAs, which was, you know, a moonwalk basically. And they did 27 kilometers over those three EVAs. So that doesn't answer your question as to what its range actually was, but that's how much they used it, about equivalent of about 5 kilometers in each direction over three different trips.
And the memory of Apollo 16 now, 50 years later, it achieved its goals, but you've mentioned all the glitches. What impresses me in your recounting, Rob, and also in reading through the Wikipedia, is how daring they were. What we know now and they didn't know then, and the digitalization of NASA and our ability to communicate, or even our understanding of the surface of the moon, is profoundly different. They were voyaging into the unknown, is my measure of reading what they did.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that the general public were already starting to tune out because of various different things that had happened with previous missions. And the Vietnam War was in full steam ahead, and people were becoming less interested. Regardless of that, these guys flew almost a perfect mission, even with all these little glitches that were going on. They were doing an extraordinary amount of exploration in a really hazardous environment. And that anecdote I told you about the orange juice, I mean, at one point they were thinking they might have to sleep with their helmets on the moon, because they were afraid if they took them off, they might not get them back on again. Those kinds of things, and the lunar dirt that they were absolutely covered in, it, and that was getting into the seals of their gloves like grit, you know, like sandpaper. Those kinds of risks, I don't think anybody would even consider taking them today.
David, we have about a minute.
Do you think that the moon buggy was a huge advance in what they could do, and could it somehow have been used to keep on going past Apollo 17 now that they had something really different from before?
It's interesting, David. Somebody said that if they figured if they went up there and put batteries back in those rovers, they'd probably still work. I don't know if that's true, but you know, it gave them a capability to do things that they certainly couldn't have done without it. One of the hazards of driving it, of course, was that when you were driving into the sun, they actually couldn't see if they were going into a crater or just over a very sloping rise. So they were taking enormous risks. And John Young said that he was not happy driving it above 6 or 7 kilometers into the sun, 6 or 7 kilometers per hour. Whereas down sun, he was a little bit more risky. And I think they got it up to 17 kilometers an hour at one point. It was a real hack, if you would use today's terminology.
1972, 50 years ago, April 1972, just like yesterday, David Livingston, Dr. Space, and we thank Rob Godwin, our guide, RCG Publishing. This is Hotel Mars. I'm John Bachelor.